Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to our weekly Global Health Forum on Blog Talk Radio. This program is brought to you by People to People, an Ethiopian diaspora volunteer healthcare organization. The show airs every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. You may listen to our radio shows by using the link provided on the P2P website or by dialing 646-595-4742. If you wish to speak to us, please press 1 when prompted to speak. You can also email your questions and comments to info@peoplepeople.org. Today is July 17, 2014, and I'm your host, Dr. Lydia Tesfa. Asthma is the most common chronic disease of childhood, affecting millions of children around the world. In the United States alone, it is estimated that nearly 5 million youngsters under the age of 18 have the disease. In 1993 alone, asthma was the reason for almost 200,000 hospital stays and about 340 deaths among persons under age 25. The disease is more common in non-whites than whites. A survey done by the government indicated that more blacks than whites died of the disease from 1980 to 1993. Among infants aged 0 to 4 years, blacks were 6 times more likely to die from asthma than whites. According to CDC, if one considers recent patterns by ethnicity, non-Hispanic black and Puerto Rican children have higher prevalence rates compared to non-Hispanic white children. Moreover, rates in adverse outcomes such as emergency department visits, hospitalizations, and deaths are substantially higher for black children. The disparity in asthma mortality between black and white children has increased in recent years. To talk about childhood asthma and health disparities, I'd like to welcome Dr. Gedau Dempsey, who is a professor and chair of epidemiology, School of Public Health, and the director of the Institute for the Elimination of Health Disparities at Rutgers, the State University of New Jersey. Dr. Dempsey was trained in medicine, epidemiology, and health service research, and has an accomplished track record of research in the areas of social, biological determinants of perinatal, respiratory, and cancer outcomes. To discern the biologic and social aspects of racial disparity, Dr. Dempsey is conducting several externally funded studies on a cohort of breast cancer patients in New Jersey. Dr. Dempsey is one of the university's master educators with a distinguished career in teaching and mentoring several medical, graduate, postdoctoral, and junior faculty members. He's published in more than 200 peer-reviewed scientific journals. Dr. Dempsey is a recipient of numerous educators' awards. In addition to his leading role in research and teaching, Dr. Dempsey serves as a member of the governance committee of the Regional Health Equity Council for Region 2 that was established by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Dr. Dempsey, it's a pleasure to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you, Lydia, for giving me this opportunity to come and talk to you guys about asthma. I really appreciate it.
Let me start my first question by asking you to describe to us what asthma is.
Asthma is a medical condition that usually causes narrowing of the small airways in the lung. Our lung has large airways and smaller airways. In asthma, typically the small airways are affected and there will be twitching and narrowing of those airways. And when the patient tries to breathe in, he can breathe in, but trying to breathe out is the difficulty, and the air will be actually trapped in the lungs. So it's a very complex disease, and you know, sometimes if it doesn't get treated on time, it could be actually lethal and life-threatening.
So is the attack temporary or is it a long-term attack?
The nature of the disease is that the disease is a transient. The bronchial constriction or twitching of the airways is usually transient and it's reversible, but it occurs recurrently. Especially with treatment, you can reverse the airway narrowing with bronchodilators or with drugs that relax the airway muscles. But it comes again and again. That's why it has a recurrent nature. So in most kids, the kids can actually grow out of asthma around puberty because of hormonal changes in their body, but in some kids actually it can stay into adulthood. In adults also it can stay for a longer period of time. So it's a chronic disease definitely, but the asthmatic attack or the narrowing of the airways is usually reversible and transient.
What are the symptoms? You've described some of them, but as a physician, what are you looking for if you are to detect asthma?
Yeah, asthma is a very heterogeneous disease. You know, a lot of people would like to say asthma is one disease, but actually the manifestations could be many. The most common symptom in asthma is wheezing. Wheezing is a high-pitched whistling sound when you try to breathe out. That's wheezing. And usually a lot of people have difficulty understanding what wheezing or wheeze is. And it's also complicated by the language differences. For example, in French, because I lived in Canada for many years, the French word wheezing is very difficult for people to understand. In the United States, probably people understand wheezing easily, but in countries, in developing countries, including Ethiopia, wheezing is also not easy to understand. So one of the symptoms is wheezing. But to make really life easy for people, there is an international collaboration on childhood asthma. It's actually International Study of Asthma and Allergies in Childhood. It's called ISAAC. Has standardized the symptoms and put it in a video showing individuals and patients how the patient with the asthma attack manifests these conditions like wheezing, so that there will not be ambiguity, and that helps to standardize the understanding of the symptoms and also to be able to do research. So wheezing is a high-pitched whistling sound, as I said, when the patient breathes out that you hear. So that's a main one of the main symptoms of asthma, and it gets really worse at night. Another one is asthmatic patients usually come with cough. And this cough is, in children particularly, is worse, particularly at night. And, you know, most patients with asthma will have wheezing accompanied by cough, but some patients may not have wheeze. They can only present with cough only, and we call that a cough variant asthma. And other additional symptoms include recurrent difficulty in breathing, chest tightness is another symptom usually patients describe, and phlegm or increased mucus production accompanied with some kind of sputum is also another symptom that usually patients present with asthma. So these are the main symptoms, but as I said, you know, the disease is heterogeneous and some patients can present only with cough, particularly with night cough, which really wakes them up from sleep, and that could be the single single manifestation of asthma. But of all the symptoms that I described, probably the most pathognomonic symptoms are wheezing and cough are the most commonly occurring symptoms.
So do the symptoms vary as the disease progresses? In other words, are there any stages of the disease?
Yeah. Definitely asthma, you can classify actually asthma as two major types or by severity, and one of them is intermittent asthma and the other one is persistent. So in intermittent asthma, usually the symptoms actually occur, like the symptoms of wheezing, cough and so forth, occur for about 2 days a week, and when you measure also the lung function of these patients is usually reasonably normal. In other words, it is greater than 80% of what is expected or predicted. Their predicted value is usually calculated because depending on the height the weight, the height, the age, and also the sitting height of the patient, the lung function actually can vary physiologically and normally. So when we talk about lung function in terms of percentage, we have to take into account those variables that I described now. So when the lung function is corrected for height, weight, body mass index, and also sitting height particularly is important, if the lung function is greater, usually it will be greater than 80% of the predicted value, and if the number of symptoms occurs for 2 or less days, then it is an intermittent asthma, and the treatment for that is usually a short-acting bronchodilator will be the treatment. On the other hand, there is a persistent asthma. The persistent asthma actually occurs for more days, so it is classified as mild persistent, moderate persistent, and severe. The mild persistent is usually the symptoms occur greater than 2 days a week, but not on a daily basis. And the lung function of these patients is normal, about 80% of the predicted. The moderate one, the moderate persistence, the daily, the symptoms is almost daily, and the lung function usually is lower than the normal, 60 to 80% predicted. But the severe persistent ones, obviously, several times a day they will have the symptoms of wheezing, cough, and their lung function is below 60%. Lung function is measured, you know, we'll ask the patient to blow into a spirometer hard, and we measure the flow of air when the patient will actually inhale first and blow out the air, and we can measure the flow of air from the small airways into the machine. And usually the forced expiratory volume in 1 second, or the ratio of the forced expiratory volume over the forced vital capacity, the capacity of the whole lung, is a ratio which tells you 60%, 80%, and so forth. So in these patients, in the severe persistent patients, their lung function is below 60% usually.
Yeah. Therefore, this disease might be referred to a long-term or a chronic disease. And this chronic disease is also sometimes referred to an allergic disease. So why is it referred to as an allergic disease? Can you perhaps explain to us, for most of us who are not physicians, to explain it in a very layman words, what is an allergic disease?
Yeah, okay, that's a good question. So, you know, allergic diseases is a broader term, and actually it encompasses several diseases. One of them is asthma, and the variety of syndromes that are included, clinical entities or syndromes that are included in allergic diseases, include, you know, eczema, manifestation of eczema, that's a skin condition where children will have a lot of itching and also oozing on their skin. Hay fever is another one, and asthma is another one. All these are allergic diseases, and even allergic rhinitis can be considered as part of allergic diseases. What all allergic diseases have in common is a characteristic called atopy. And atopy is a genetic predisposition for mounting an immunoglobulin. Immunoglobulin, predominantly immunoglobulin E, in response to a common allergen. In other words, when our body is exposed to certain proteins, specific proteins, then the body mounts an immunoglobulin response to that allergen. And that is predominantly an IgE allergy. There are many types of immunoglobulins, but in asthma and allergic diseases, typically it is the IgE which is actually produced. So atopy is almost always associated with increased levels of IgE in our blood, in our tissues, and it's believed to play a very central role in the causation or in the pathogenesis of allergic diseases. So atopy is common to almost all allergic diseases, including eczema, hay fever, and asthma. And, for example, atopy is almost always present in about 80% of children with asthma, with childhood asthma, have atopy. Studies that are done in Tucson, Arizona, where the asthma rate is quite high, almost all patients with asthma have some kind of IgE-mediated reaction. In other words, they have atopy. So that is the reason why, you know, all these diseases are called atopic or allergic diseases, because they have a common denominator, which is the production or the mount, the mounting immunoglobulin E in response to exposure to common allergens or proteins. When I say allergens, I'm talking about, you know, dust mites, for example. Dust mites are found in dust, and they have a specific kind of proteins. So if when we inhale those proteins, our body actually produces an immunoglobulin called IgE. That is allergy-related reaction that occurs after exposure to those type of proteins. Even cats, you know, if you take cats, the fur of the cat also contains proteins, and Feldi proteins they are called, and they also, on exposure, they can also induce immunoglobulin E. In dust mite, the specific allergen is called DERP, and that also produces the same kind of reaction. So the common denominator in all this is atopy.
This protein that you have mentioned, the immunoglobulin E, that is produced by important cells in the body, can it be also inherited from mother to a child or no?
I mean, the tendency can be inherited. The tendency to be atopic usually is inherited because there is a very strong association between parental asthma and childhood asthma, particularly when the mother is atopic or asthmatic. The probability that the child will be atopic or asthmatic is very high. So the tendency to be atopic is definitely inherited, and there are specific genes that are isolated on specific chromosomes. Definitely it plays a genetic role, is implicated in asthma and in allergies, and it goes from generation to generation, or from parents to children.
Mm. Is childhood asthma any different from adult asthma?
The pathophysiologic mechanisms, the determinants, most of the characteristics are very similar. The only difference is, you know, children can usually grow out of asthma when they reach puberty, as I said before, because of changes in their hormone. In some hormones, you know, make the asthma better, and it may not come back again in this in some children. And, you know, during puberty, there is a lot of production of steroids and so forth. And we use steroids also to treat asthma. Because of those changes, natural changes in our body, children actually can grow out of asthma. The other difference is in very young children, you know, clinically, people, to reduce anxiety, parental anxiety and so forth, people actually don't use the word asthma. Probably airway reactive disease is the commonly used word, but the pathophysiologic mechanism in airway reactive disease and asthma are quite similar. And you know, the other thing I didn't explain about atopy is what happens is, you know, first you'll be exposed to those allergens that I discussed earlier, proteins. So at that time, your body mounts IgEs, and then there will be, you know, the cells that produce these immunoglobulins have memories. So during a second exposure because of anamnestic or memory related things, they will recognize these proteins easily and they produce more immunoglobulin and other interleukins and so forth, and there will be degranulation of the mast cells in our thymus, and that degranulation of cells releases further, you know, chemicals that actually cause, like histamine and so forth, that would really cause twitching of the airways and narrowing of the smaller airways. That's why you will have twitching when you are exposed many times. So, in, you know, basically in kids and in adults, the disease is quite similar, but children can grow out of it in most instances.
Yeah. So you've briefly mentioned that perinatal and early childhood environmental exposures that promote the development of childhood asthma. Can you talk about, give us some examples?
Yeah, I mean, the causes of asthma are very complex. You know, it's very hard to say one thing will cause asthma. Like if you take tuberculosis, we know that Mycobacterium leprae, one bacteria, Mycobacterium tuberculosis, one bacteria will cause the disease, tuberculosis. Or if we talk about leprosy, probably Mycobacterium leprae. But in asthma, the etiologies, the mechanisms of causation are very complex, and a lot of things actually can be involved in the causation of asthma. For example, the frequency of asthma clearly varies by countries. As I said earlier, the International Study of Asthma and Allergies in Childhood, Isaac, employed a standard kind of methodology to determine the frequency of asthma and atopic diseases in about 150 centers in 56 countries globally, involving about 1 million children. And what they found was, you know, in countries like the New Zealand, Australia, UK, the Republic of Ireland, the frequency or occurrence of asthma is very high. Whereas using the same methodology in countries like Ethiopia, Eastern Europe, Indonesia, the frequency of this disease is very low. Like in Ethiopia, it's about 5% of the population, whereas if you come to the US or New Zealand and the United Kingdom, it goes up to 20%. And the other related thing is, you know, as people move from country of origin to more developed countries, then the prevalence of asthma also shifts. For example, if you take the first generation of immigrants who moved from Ethiopia to Israel, then after they stayed in the host country, which is Israel, for some years, then the prevalence of asthma in that population will be intermediate between Ethiopia and Israel. But the second generation of kids who are born in Israel, Ethiopian kids who are born in Israel, their risk of or frequency of asthma is almost similar to the, you know, their current host country, which is Israel. So the asthma rate in these kids will be almost the same as the rate among the Israelites. You know, all these things tells you, what it tells us is that lifestyle factors could be really an important contribution, because these people are moving from countries where the environment is different, the way they live, the lifestyle is very different to a very different country. So in the condition of asthma, there are several things which can really work together. And you can actually categorize them as host, environmental, and lifestyle factors. And in the past few decades, there was, you know, there has been an increase in the frequency of allergic diseases, particularly in industrialized countries. There was a hypothesis that it may be because of the, you know, the way we diagnose asthma more now than before. But studies that looked at, you know, the same population using similar methodologies were able to confirm that the increase in these allergic diseases and asthma is actually real. So, you know, the possibilities are, why are these things really increasing dramatically? It could be because of maybe changes in the genetic makeup of the population, one possibility, but it's very unlikely that, you know, the gene pool of a very stable population would change within one century. So probably it's very unlikely that changes in the genetics will play a role. But the, you know, the population or the host, the people who are getting the disease, can be more susceptible for several reasons, or the environment could be more toxic, or there may be changes in lifestyle changes. As I said before, could be responsible, or the interaction of these things could be responsible for the increase in asthma over time. So when we talk about, you know, change in the host susceptibility, or a more susceptible host, we are actually talking about maybe exposure during pregnancy can actually make the child who is in utero to be more susceptible for the development of allergic diseases. And from birth, that child will be more prone to develop atopy and as a result, allergic diseases. And one of the reasons why asthma and other allergic diseases are increasing could be that. And there are many, a lot of evidence suggesting that exposure during the prenatal period to allergen is associated to some tendency in the child when he was born to be atopic. For example, if a mother is exposed to dust mites, which is a protein, cockroach protein, or cat proteins, there is clear evidence that these proteins actually pass the placenta, and because they are found in the amniotic fluid, and also by taking the cord blood of the kids when they were born, it was clearly shown that, you know, the balance of the T cells, Th1, Th2 balance, where Th2 is more indicative of atopy than Th1, is clearly tilted because of exposure to prenatal allergen exposure. And the cord blood can be used actually to determine what type of cytokines that are produced more as a result of exposure to these allergens. Fetal infection like which is commonly occurring in the United States, preterm birth is really increasing, and also nobody knows why preterm birth is also increasing in developed countries. But one possibility is chorioamnionitis, which is an infection of the chorion, and as a result, the fetus also could be infected. That also is clearly shown to tilt the Th1, Th2 balance to more of to Th2, which is AtoP related. Maternal diet, particularly, you know, high calories, is also shown to be associated. Maternal stress, length of gestation, as I said, related to preterm birth. Breastfeeding is another one. Widespread use of antibiotics. All these things are related, you know, are likely to change the genetic predisposition or the atopy propensity for the child actually before birth. The other is a more toxic environment could be a possible explanation. Like, you know, there are a lot of studies that there is a study in particular done by a German physician, von Mutius is her name. She actually compared the asthma and allergy rate between East and West Germany. And, you know, at that time, East Germany was more polluted than West, but West Germany, the lifestyle is similar to the United States, where you have a lot of carpets in the house. Carpets are, you know, the main offenders in having dust and dust mites. And it's more green, West Germany, than East. Definitely the allergy and also the asthma rate was much higher in West than in the East. And that suggests basically it's not really the pollution which is responsible in the causation of asthma, but maybe a Western lifestyle related to dust mite, carpet use, and so forth are more important. Because, you know, a lot of kids also spend their time indoor than outdoor, at least in this part of the universe. You know, indoor allergens and irritants are more important than the outdoor ones. The outdoor ones are clearly, they will precipitate symptoms once you have asthma, but they may not be the causation of the problem, the asthma. But the indoor allergens, like aeroallergens, like dust mite, cockroach, cat, are the main problem actually in causing asthma in children who are exposed. Actually, the first study came several years ago from the UK, showing that children who are exposed to house dust mite during their first 6 months of life are clearly at higher risk of developing asthma and allergies, and the evidence in that study was very clear. It was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. But as to irritants like particulate matter, 10, PM2.5, NO2, SO4, indoor, it's not very clear whether they really cause asthma. But if you have, once the patient has asthma, then they are likely to be, you know, to exacerbate symptoms.
Hmm. You clearly indicated that asthma does complicate pregnancy, and it's also
you know, the other thing. Let me finish one thing. I was talking about lifestyle thing. You know, one study, what is interesting is there is a very strong relationship between atopy and asthma. As I said, almost all asthmatic kids are atopic. And atopic could be measured by the serum IgE, or it could be measured by skin prick test, and there is also a newer technology to measure atopy. But, you know, almost all the time there is a very strong relationship between atopy and asthma. But there was two studies in Jimma, Ethiopia, and another one in a very remote area in Canada among Inuits. Those two studies, actually, they don't really show an association between atopy and asthma, which is quite surprising. In Jimma, the skin prick test result shows about 30-40%, but the asthma rate was quite low, like 6%.
Mm-hmm.
In the remote Canada Inuit population, also the same kind of characteristics. What I'm trying to get at is, you know, lifestyle factors like exercise probably also can contribute and mediate the translation of atopy to asthma. And if there is more activities where kids actually go to school on foot in Ethiopia, probably that may have helped the dissociation or the lack of translation. The same in Inuits, because they are mostly physical, they do a lot of physical things. Probably that may have played a role.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, I don't know if I'm taking a lot of your time.
No, go ahead. It's quite interesting topic.
Yeah, another thing is, you know, when we say exercise in kids, also there is a very different types of asthma, which is exercise-induced bronchospasm. And when they try to, you know, exercise, run, or play, they may have asthma symptoms and attack. But the recommendation is not to discourage kids not to play, but before actually they start the exercise, they can take a bronchodilator and continue their exercise. That's what I want to add. Okay,
yeah.
Go ahead.
It's also important to treat pregnant women with asthma, not to have that complication then.
The pregnant woman with asthma,
yeah.
That's also another interesting area, because, you know, when a woman is pregnant, they are really afraid of taking medications. And a lot of women, you know, they try to avoid taking medication, thinking that, you know, the medication may hurt the baby. But, you know, one has to balance the risk between having a severe asthmatic attack versus taking the medication. Most of the medications are safe, and it is better to take the medication and control the asthma during pregnancy than really suffer from, acute complications. It could be life-threatening, and even if it is not life-threatening, uncontrolled asthma actually can cause several complications during pregnancy, including, conditions related with preterm birth, placenta previa, which is a low-lying placenta, and abruption of the placenta, which is premature separation of the placenta from the uterine wall, which can lead to severe bleeding and very risky. So, you know, it is important actually. You know, the course of asthma during pregnancy varies from person to person. In about one third of the patients, if a woman has asthma before pregnancy, in one third of the cases, the asthma actually stays the same. In one third, it gets worse, and in another third, actually, it gets better. So it's hard to really predict the course of asthma during pregnancy.
To our listeners who have just joined us, this is our weekly Global Health Forum brought to you by People to People. And our guest this evening is Dr. Gadal Dempsey, who is a professor of medicine and epidemiology at Rutgers State University. If you'd like to talk to us, please press 1 by dialing 646-595-4742. Tell us about the methods of diagnosis.
Of asthma?
Of asthma, yes.
Yeah. You know, the main method of diagnosing asthma, I mean, which is, you know, probably most practical, is history. You know, you should ask patients what their symptoms are. And the symptoms we discussed earlier, they will tell you they have wheezing, and they have cough, and the wheezing and the cough becomes worse at night. And they will have chest tightness and phlegm or mucus production, all those things they will tell you. So those are, especially if somebody tells you they have wheezing, you have to really suspect that they have asthma. Of course, you have to exclude other causes of airway obstruction. But the distinct thing about asthma is, as I said earlier, it is reversible. So if you do a pulmonary function test in patients, and if the pulmonary function test, which I described earlier, is lower, you have to demonstrate that it is reversible. So if when you give them a medicine which relaxes the bronchial muscles, the bronchodilator, then the lung function should really come back to a good level, as compared to the lung function they had when they have the asthma attack. So demonstration that the obstruction is reversible is very important. So the basic diagnosis is history, physical, then you have pulmonary function test. But you can also do other type of tests to see. They are more of what we call bronchial provocation tests. That includes histamine challenge and methacholine challenge. So you can actually give them some medications, breathing medications, to see how their airway reacts. And you can take their lung function, how it decreases with the histamine and methacholine, and if the decline in lung function is more than 20%, then clearly those are diagnostic too, in addition to the regular lung function you perform.
Yeah.
So those are the main ways of diagnosing asthma.
As mentioned earlier in my intro, I've mentioned that there seem to be patterns observed in prevalence rate among different ethnic backgrounds. And are there any scientific explanations for these differences? Why are non-white children are more exposed to asthma compared to their counterparts, white kids?
Yeah. You know, there are differences, as I say, you know, for example, by those kids or adults who live in the urban areas compared to rural areas, it's more common in the urban environment. In the United States, particularly, asthma is more common in inner cities. The rate, if you look at the hospitalization rate, which you were mentioning at the beginning of the talk, within New York, for example, the hospitalization rate is much higher in Harlem compared to Manhattan. If you go to Chicago, there are some counties where a lot of African Americans live. The rate of asthma hospitalization is much higher than the rest of Chicago. So, and the same is true in around Washington D.C. and also in New Jersey, where I live. There are some areas where the prevalence of asthma is much higher in inner cities. And part of the reason for that is, as I said, it's still exposure. You know, the kids in these inner cities are exposed to a lot of dust mites because, you know, the housing is very different than the rest of in the rural areas. You have more space, probably you keep your windows open and so forth. But in inner cities, there are a lot of carpets, a lot of socioeconomic status related issues like cockroach and so forth. All those things actually have exposure, as I said earlier, proteins or allergens, which are likely to cause asthma and also to exacerbate asthma. So it is more related to socioeconomic status and the lower socioeconomic status actually predispose you to these allergens more frequently than to the kids in the higher socioeconomic status. So the racial difference is partly that. The second is, you know, in the management of asthma, the most important thing is continuity of care. You have to establish a primary care physician and regularly go to be examined and seen by that primary care physician, and that person should also work with you on an action plan and be able to monitor your symptoms and disease condition and adjust your treatments accordingly. And a lot of African Americans, they are uninsured, as we know, and they don't have the health insurance privilege to go and have a regular physician for maintenance treatment or for having continuity of care. Actually, there is clear evidence in the literature that in some areas, poorer communities use emergency room as their routine continuity of care, not continuity, as a routine, you know, regular physician. They use the emergency room because they don't have insurance. They can't really afford, or they don't have the ability to go and see a doctor regularly. So because of those things, you know, the hospitalization and so forth and the severity of asthma in these patients is particularly high. The burden is also particularly high.
And lack of health care or the lack of quality care does exasperate the situation. And the new health care system, which is commonly known as Obamacare, do you think would alleviate or try to alleviate this problem?
Yeah, I mean, in this country, 40 million people are uninsured. So the idea is that to get insurance to these people, some kind of insurance. So definitely it will help patients. You know, I lived in Canada, I studied in Canada, where you have universal healthcare systems here. The problem associated with you know, having a regular doctor is not there. At least you get the basic kind of care there. So definitely, you know, having the Obamacare insurance definitely will help a lot of people in having a regular maintenance kind of care to avoid complications and avoid going to emergency room. It will definitely also reduce costs. Because emergency room and hospitalizations are more costly than having a regular physician.
Yeah. In our discussion that we had previously, you have mentioned to me that you would be very much interested to start a collaborative project between yourself and research colleagues back in Ethiopia. Can you talk about these potential collaborative areas?
Yeah, sure. You know, I have a lot of interest, which, you know, I didn't get the time to work on. But hopefully soon I will start, you know, thinking and putting together something. One thing is in the areas of asthma, obviously, as I said earlier, the translation of allergy or atopy to asthma is less in Ethiopia compared to the United States, and I really want to understand what mechanisms actually play there, because it will help also to improve the prevention of asthma in this country. So you can learn a lot of things from there. But the second thing is in the areas of breast cancer. We do a lot of, I do a lot of molecular kind of studies in the United States, including, you know, gene methylation and so forth. And currently, actually, we got a huge grant from the National Cancer Institute to study biomarkers for breast cancer. But the interesting thing is African Americans here have a triple negative cancer, which is estrogen, progesterone, and HER2 receptor negative, which is the most lethal cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And we really don't understand why that is the case. And, you know, it's not very clear that all women who are African descent also has, you know, the same kind of cancer. So I really want to study in Ethiopia and see whether these triple negative cancers are frequent there, and if they are frequent, how similar are to the African American population triple negative breast cancers in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another thing I really want to study.
Hmm. Dr. Geda, it's been a pleasure, and we hope to hear from you another time. Thank you.
Thank you.
We've come to the end of our show. You can submit your comments and suggestions through info@peoplepeople.org or People to People Facebook page. You can access the archived show using the link on the People to People website. Thank you for listening. I'm your host, Dr. Lydia Tesfa. I'll be back with you the third week of next month with another segment of Global Health Forum. Stay engaged.